We're taking up the question as to the paragraph in the Haggadah, which starts off by saying, Yechol Merosh Chodesh. I would have thought from Rosh Chodesh, which is the early paragraphs in the Haggadah, in which we're detailing different aspects of the mitzvah. So, as we've said, the Sefer begins with the study of the ideas pertaining to the Sefer, which is very interesting in its own right. Because generally speaking, we don't do that. We just go to a mitzvah, we have a mitzvah to do, we do the mitzvah. For example, on Sukkot, I mean, if you study, you study. You want to study to learn how to build the sukkah or whatever it is, but there's nothing preparatory as you have over here. It's not that before we go into the sukkah, we have a whole ritual of reciting passages and so forth. You just go in and do it. Over here, the mitzvah itself carries with it a study of the mitzvah. So that's interesting. What makes this mitzvah unique? Why is that the case? The reason has to do with the fact that the mitzvah of Sefer is a completely different kind of a mitzvah. The essence of the mitzvah is to speak, to explain, to elucidate, to understand, to develop the ideas. And as we said, that it's not just Sefer for the sake of Sefer, but it has a goal, it has an objective. And the objective is a certain renewal of one's relationship with God, which is founded upon a certain sense of appreciation. So therefore, one cannot engage in this mitzvah. The very essence of the mitzvah is understanding, directly. The other mitzvahs enjoins us to perform a certain activity. Now that activity leads us in a certain direction, and it has an aim and a goal and a purpose. But the basic requirement at the time of the mitzvah is to perform the action, to do the mitzvah. And provided you had the right object and you had the intention, you perform the mitzvah. The purpose of performing the mitzvah, the purpose is so that the ideas that are associated with it will be perpetuated. They'll be there, they'll be learned, they'll be studied. But that's, you have a difference between the performance and that's the purpose. Okay, that's up to you now. That's perfection. It's clear that people can become very perfunctory. Depends on your level. People can become very perfunctory and get into the habit of performing these acts, make them into rituals, and not study what their purposes are. But there is clearly a difference between the two. The action and the purpose of the action. That's a big problem, to the extent that we don't really fulfill the purpose of the mitzvahs. But with regard to Sefer, it's different. It's meaningless. You can't just get up and say meaningless things. You cannot be an individual who partakes of Sefer if you're not understanding what you're doing. Here, the whole essence is understanding. So that's why you have these chapters that are instructing you. You need instruction in Sefer. Another thing, bear in mind, most of the other mitzvos, from a technical standpoint, are not really that difficult. It's not difficult to go into a sukkah. Most of the actions, the mitzvos, are not that difficult to do. However, Sefer is complex. Sefer is not an action. Its whole essence is intellectual. So that's another reason. Put a different way, other mitzvos where there is a distinct action, like picking up a lulav. So that's the command, that's the mitzvah. Then there's a separate arena called the reasons for the mitzvah, and that's always a separate compartment. And you have to search for it and so forth. But as a result of performing the mitzvah, that will stimulate your interest in trying to find out what the reason is, and you'll study it. But the performance of the mitzvah is something separate. So that if a person doesn't really understand what the idea of the lulav is, he still can do the mitzvah. He knows it's a mitzvah, so he performs the mitzvah. It's a simple action, picks it up. makes the blessing right before he recites it and picks it up. I would say a little further with regard to the mitzvah of Sipur, we have this categorization of mitzvos being mitzvos that are performed by the body, and then we have the category of mitzvos halev. In fact, there's the famous work called Duties of the Heart, Chovos Halavavos, Obligations of the Heart, that the entire mitzvah is belev, is in the heart. So I would include this, that Sipur, even though it's done verbally, there's verbalization. He has all the categories. Of course, he separates between verbalization, between action, and things that are purely in the heart. We could review that. That's not a bad idea. For example, what would be a mitzvah which is purely of the heart? Sipur I would put in the category of verbalization. But the kiyum of Sipur, when I say kiyum, I mean the objective, is in the heart. That is, a person just recites and he's not even thinking of what he's saying. It's like he's davening something and not even cognizant of what he's saying. I don't know that he has Sipur, which is an interesting question. I would say he's not fulfilling the mitzvah of Sipur. It has to be cognizant. Questions being raised as to why there is no specific bracha for the mitzvah of Sipur. I would think that you have a bracha on a mitzvah where there is a distinct formalized action of the mitzvah and you fulfill it. So for example, matzah is a classical mitzvah which entails a certain action, and of course that action requires a certain object. So it's a special kind of an action which has been mandated by the mitzvah. We call a maisa ha-mitzvah, an action of mitzvah. So you make a bracha. The same is true for the maror. The same is true for lulav, sukkah. Whenever you have an abstract, objective, technical activity which constitutes the mitzvah, generally speaking, you have a bracha. However, that is not the case with Sipur. Sipur is a process which has a certain objective. But it's very, very, even though it's true we have the Haggadah, but the nature of, and even in, with the Haggadah, there's a lot of subjectivity involved, because you stop, you pause, you explain. Each person does it in his own way. It's a process. So that type of a mitzvah is not precluded by a bracha. The mitzvah itself, the very performance of the mitzvah, also entails the praising of God, recitation of Hallel, and so on. So that objective of praising God in conjunction with the mitzvah is fulfilled in the very performance of the mitzvah. So we have different kinds of mitzvahs. We have a mitzvah which is a physical performance, physical action. Then we have mitzvahs which are verbalizations, prayer. But the mitzvah of prayer, for example, the objective, the fulfillment is in the heart. That is to elicit a certain awareness of the heart, the mind. A person who just mumbles words and doesn't have any connection doesn't really fulfill the mitzvah. It has to be something which affects the heart. Then we have mitzvahs of the heart per se. That is, the love of God, belief in God, the unity of God. There's no action involved at all, nor is there necessarily any verbalization. If a person's obligated to have a certain awareness, conviction with regard to certain things, that's mitzvos shebalev. There are mitzvos pertaining to the heart. I wonder, the mitzvah of the ahavta l'reicha kamocha, you shall love your friend as yourself, first and foremost entails behaviors. It's a behavioral phenomenon. Essentially, can be stated not to mistreat your fellow Jew, not to subject that person to a different level of treatment that you would want. That's like yourself. And that is all of the things that you feel you are entitled to because of your dignity, human dignity. You should treat your fellow in the same manner. The question is whether there's any aspect of the heart there too. I would say that there is. Though, if a person doesn't have that feeling of the heart, a certain feeling, a certain attitude, they're not in violation, provided that the behavior is correct. That is, it's not demanding that you feel a certain way. It demands that you behave. So even if you don't feel that way, that's a high level of perfection. That even if you don't feel that way, but you don't act according to your feeling. That is, you really don't want to treat this person respectfully, but you pause and you think about it and you recognize that you can't act according to your feeling. Your feeling is not the barometer. And you overcome the feeling, that's a very high level. However, there is a level of the heart. That is where you cultivate a certain compassion and respect for people on the basis of the fact that they partake of Tzelem Elokim, the divine image. I want to digress a little bit, perhaps, and take up an area of the four sons, which I think requires a little bit more attention. The second son, the Rasha, translated basically as the wicked son, or the evil son. We see something interesting, that this individual is asking a question. And on the basis of the question, it's not that clear why you would describe such a person as wicked. It does seem harsh. This is the second of the sons. Yet it's being pointed out that the source, everything we do at the Seder has a source in the Torah. And the idea of the four sons comes to us from the Torah. Because we will find that in the Torah, it depicts our sons asking questions in four different places. Pretty much, they all pretty similar. But nevertheless, when you go back in the Torah, it doesn't say, for example, if you take a look in Devarim, which is the source for the wise son, who says, what are these testimonies and the statutes and judgments that God commanded you? It doesn't say anything about the wise son. All the sons are just depicted as sons. And it doesn't say in the Torah that this is the wise son. The question that the Rasha asks is found in Shemos, chapter 12, verse 26. This is in the Parsha, which talks about the Passover sacrifice. And Bo contains an extensive description of all the requirements of the Passover sacrifice, mainly about the so-called Pesach Mitzrayim. As I've explained, this is the only sacrifice, well, the only mitzvah, pretty much, aside from the ones that had been given to them. A certain amount of mitzvahs had been given to them, progressively. Abraham, Yitzhak, Yaakov, and so forth. Circumcision was given to Abraham, although it lapsed in Egypt, as we learned. But they didn't have the Passover sacrifice. So the first Passover sacrifice was actually done in Egypt. And that's the subject matter of the chapter, where Moshe commands from God, communicates the command of God, that they should prepare the animal and slaughter the animal, and the sprinkling of the blood on the doorposts, the specific way in which they were supposed to eat the food. Now, and then God saying that he will pass over the entire land of Egypt on that night, and he will see the blood and pass over. That, of course, is not to be taken literally in the obvious sense. It's conveying an idea that God will spare those houses that have the blood because they performed the mitzvah. Then it says in verse 23 mentions that point, that Hashem will pass over to smite Egypt and he will see the blood on the doorpost, on the lintel and the doorposts, and God will skip over the door and he will not allow the destroyer to come to your houses to destroy. The clear implication being that those Jews that didn't do it would be subject to being killed as well. But the plague was, it wasn't that the plague wouldn't afflict the Jews. As far as this is concerned, Jews would be those people who performed the mitzvah. Then, Ushmartem es hadavar hazeh, you shall guard this matter, meaning the Passover sacrifice. L'chak l'cha, for a statute unto you and your children, ad olam, forever. Forever, what does that mean, forever? Well, I've been making a big point of the fact that the Torah is eternal, it doesn't terminate. There's no termination point. However, the question arises, we haven't done this in a long time. The last time there was a Passover sacrifice, a long time ago. You all know the reason. That's because sacrifices can only be brought in the temple. That's something to study. This is so significant, it's so important. The emphasis upon the Passover sacrifice plays such a central role in Judaism that one would think that there shouldn't be anything standing in the way, no hindrance to it. And yet, it's based upon there's something else, there's another factor. That is to say that at a certain point in time, once the temple is built, sacrifices cannot be brought outside the temple. So you can't utilize that reasoning that, well, the real intent of the Torah is that the Jews should have the Passover sacrifice, and you see that they had it even before the temple, and a person could rationalize his way around this and make a case that it's supposed to be eternal. How is it eternal if we're not doing it? The answer is, eternal means that it won't be abrogated. That's a different idea. Eternal does not necessarily mean consecutive. That's a very important idea to understand. For example, we have another thing which is similar, eternal, if you will. That is the kingship. The kingship was given over to David, King David, the Davidic family. That's the ultimate kingship. Even though it didn't preclude other tribes, other individuals, from becoming the king. It wasn't established that way. Other individuals could become the king, provided that they had the criteria, whatever it is. But their kingship would always be temporary, just an accident. But the permanent kingship was given to David. But that doesn't mean that it would be an uninterrupted phenomenon. So there's a difference between being permanent in the Torah, lingo of the Torah, permanent and uninterrupted is two different things. So when here it says about the Passover sacrifice that it will be a statute for you and your children forever, it doesn't mean uninterrupted. But it does mean that, what? It will never be abrogated. That's a completely different idea. In the same way that the land of Israel was given to us, it was given to us permanently. But that doesn't mean uninterrupted. It means that the connection between the Jews and the land will never be abrogated. So that it'll be interrupted, but then it'll be restored. Then it says it'll be when you come to the land that Hashem gives you, as He has promised, then you will guard this service. So in the land, the Jews were commanded to do the service. Which is to say, don't think that this is something which is only attendant in the land of Egypt. But it's always going to be done. And we explain the reason, the Ramban. Because the next, after God performed these signs for us, we were instructed to memorialize them, to make a permanent memorialization. Because they contain eternal ideas. And the Ramban says, God is not going to come down, so to speak, in every generation to refute the views of heretics. This was a one-time thing. So it's our task to memorialize and perpetuate it. So a key element is the Passover sacrifice. Then it says, and it'll be kiyomru aleichem b'neichem, when your children will say to you, moha avoda azos lachem, what is this service to you? Okay, now that seems to be an innocent question. There's no implication at all in the Torah that there's something wrong with asking this question. Kiyomru means if he should say. If you take a look at the Sforno, he explains what the question is. the meaning of the question. What is the service, this service unto you? Meaning, she'eino biyom mikra kodesh. That he sees it. What? Why is he asking the question? Because there's something special that attracts his attention about it. Which is a good point, because why does the Torah point out this, that they'll ask about this? They could ask about any mitzvah. Why? What's the purpose of tefillin? What's the purpose of lulav? So why is the Torah singling this out? So the Sforno says that he's asking because it's unusual, that it's not on a holiday. It's on the 14th. The holiday begins on the 15th. Like the other korbanos, the other sacrifices. Nor is it during the time span of the other sacrifices, which are brought from the time of the morning, mitamit shel shachar, the time of the morning sacrifice, until the time of the evening sacrifice. This one is brought in the afternoon. And the third thing that's different is, why wouldn't one sacrifice suffice for all of Israel? Like the other community sacrifices. We have korbanos tzibur, we have community sacrifices, and one suffices for all Israel. Yet here, each person has to be signed on to a group. So that's why he's attracted, that's why he's asking the questions. Now, what shall you say to him? So it says, and you shall say, Zevach Pesach Hu Lad Hashem. It is a Passover sacrifice to Hashem. Asher Pesach Al Botei B'nei Yisrael B'Mitzrayim, who skipped over the houses of the B'nai Yisrael in Egypt, B'nag Poes Mitzrayim, when he smote Egypt, V'es Botenu Hitzil, and he saved our houses. V'yikoram V'yishtachavu, and the people kneeled and bowed. That's interesting. What do you mean, the people kneeled and bowed? What does that fit in?
It hadn't happened yet, right? When Moshe was telling
them? Yeah, that's interesting. The Torah is describing that when Moshe told them this. Moshe told them about the Passover sacrifice. And then in addition, he told them to guard it and retain it when they enter the land. And then that the children would ask, what is the service? And he gave them the answer. And then the Torah includes that the people kneeled and bowed. Rashi says, Vayikoram Al Besoros HaGeula, that they responded to the words of Moshe, which contained the Besorah, the news, the information about the redemption, that they're going to be redeemed, Ubias Aretz, and that they would have the land. If you take a look at this communication, it includes the idea that they would be redeemed, they would inherit the land, and what else? That they would have children. Ubsaras habanim sheyulahem, and the besora of children that they would have. The only thing that always piqued my interest was that the first two things I would call a besora. A besora is information that it's news. I didn't know. I wouldn't know when something happens like that. But so the geula is news, because until it happens, you don't know if it's going to happen or not. Now you're being told. And, of course, the entry into the land. But the fact that they would have children, isn't that something you can figure out? That seems to be obvious. If there's going to be a nation, they're going to be in the land, so they're going to have children. But that's not. They had children in Egypt, too. That's not a psora. So an answer is being suggested, that you have to put yourself into the framework of the mentality of people. People that are enslaved and oppressed. So it doesn't just mean that biologically they'll have children. Because they've been having children, the biological factor is one thing. But the psora, the news, so to speak, was that they'd be prosperous. That the venture would be a success. That they would be redeemed. They'd be transformed. They would be redeemed. And they would have a land, and then they'd have children, but the children would not be slave children. Were they just in Egypt, they just continued to have children because they didn't want the light to be extinguished, so to speak. That's one level. But they'll be children in the sense of a prosperous nation with a future. and perpetuation. That was what they kneeled and bowed. Yeah. Notice over here, there's no indication of anything wicked or evil about the question. And indeed, we have an answer. There's an answer to be given. There's no indication that you're supposed to blunt the teeth. Let's take a look at this forno. Zevach Pesachu. How does this answer the question? According to this forno, he said that it wasn't just a question of what is this, but what's unique about this, in the sense that it's not on the time of the holiday, it's not at the ordinary time of the day, and it's not communal in the sense of one for the entire tzibur. So the Sforno says the answer, Zevach Pesachu. Zeha Zevach, this sacrifice, Nase Bishvil HaPsicha, is done because of the Psicha, the skipping, the fact that God skipped over. Pisech is like a limp person who skips, doesn't walk straight. Shahoisa Asida Leheyosos Bechatzi Alayla Shalacharav, which was destined to be done at midnight. This is a very interesting answer. He's explaining. And since we don't have a sacrifice at night, that's not a good time for the sacrifice. It happened after midnight. So the timing had to correspond to that idea of midnight. But it couldn't be done at night because that's not the time for karbanos, not a good time. So thus, it was done on midday, after midday. The time factor is really based upon the midnight phenomenon, because it commemorates the psicha. It commemorates the beginning of the redemption, the makas b'choros, two aspects, the smiting of the firstborn, but the saving, the fact that the Jews were saved, were differentiated. So that took place right after midnight. What's the idea? The idea is that it's midday to commemorate the midnight phenomenon. Then he says, V'hutzrach kol echad lahakriv, and it was necessary for each individual to bring the sacrifice. Ki anes nasa l'chol yachid b'fnei atzmo, because the miracle was done for each individual. Lo l'tzibur b'chlal. That's a very sharp point, that the miracle was not a general one, that God saved the tzibur, but it had to do with individuals, because each individual had to define himself. Normally, for example, by the splitting of the Red Sea, that would be something which was for the sake of the Jewish people. The Egyptian army was destroyed, the Jewish people were saved as a tzibur. But over here, it didn't function as a tzibur, as a community thing. Each individual Jew had to be saved in a personal kind of way. So he experienced the salvation in a personal way, and therefore God commanded that each person has to bring his own korban to commemorate that. Now, it's very interesting to note that when you read the question, you don't have a sense that this question is being uttered by a wicked son. Certainly with these forno, there's nothing wicked about the question. Even if you just compare the question of the Rasha to the question of the Chacham, it doesn't seem to be that much difference. Slight difference in the wording. This is found in Devarim, in chapter 6, verse 20, which is preceded by an injunction that we should do that which is right and good in the eyes of God, in order that it shall be good for you, and you will come and inherit the land, the goodly land, that God swore to your fathers, to destroy all your enemies from before you, or to push away all your enemies from before you, as God has said. Then out of nowhere, ki yishalchav bin chamachar, when your children will ask you tomorrow, saying, moha edos v'yachukim v'yamishpatim, what are the testimonies, the statutes, and ordinances, Asher Tzivar Hashem Elokeinu Eschem, which the Lord our God, commanded you. Here too, the Torah itself doesn't identify the child, your son. It doesn't say that this is the wise son. Now, at this point in time, I want to inject another question, which occurred to me as I'm studying the sons. The second son, for some reason there's something wrong with this question, is referred to as a wicked son, a Rasha. This one, who asks the appropriate question, is referred to as a Chacham. Why isn't he referred to as a Tzaddik, as the righteous son? Why don't we have the righteous son? Of course, for the purpose of this evening, it's educational. So we're trying to classify everybody from an educational standpoint. So from the educational standpoint, you have to differentiate amongst your students. It is interesting that Judaism does not maintain that there's one standardized form of education for everybody. But you have to have differentiation. And the Chacham has to be taught in a certain way. Everybody's educational needs has to be met. I would also say that is the beginning of a tzaddik. That's our concept of a tzaddik. We have the idea of Ein Bur Yirei Chet, that an ignoramus, Lo Am Aretz Chassid, for example, an ignoramus can't be a pious individual. So that's a big fundamental in Judaism, again, which differentiates Judaism from all the religions. To the contrary, there's no other religion that recognizes or acknowledges that the level of understanding is essential to one's quote-unquote piety. To the contrary, they prefer the simplistic individual, and they view with suspicion someone who's thinking, who's questioning, who's trying to gain understanding. They certainly do not regard religious perfection as related to understanding, except for Judaism, where the essence is really the yediyah, the knowledge. It's not the knowledge alone, though. It's got to be a knowledge which suffuses the soul, which is internalized, obviously. So that's why he's a chacham. That's his essence, is that he's a chacham. A true chacham will live according to his wisdom. But the tzaddik, first and foremost, begins as a chacham. I don't mean to define someone as a chacham is not measured by how much he knows. Well, there's a certain quality of understanding, obviously, certain maturity of understanding. But it means that this person functions like a chacham. That doesn't mean that they're Einstein. You don't have to be the greatest gadol, in accordance with their level. But you can tell, even among people that are not as advanced in terms of how much they know, but you can say this person's a chacham because the way they operate is with chachma, with wisdom. May not be in every area that they have the chachma, but we're talking about a certain type of chachma with regard to life, certain fundamental approaches that you have. We're talking about chachma with regard to life. Chachma sachayim. Now, as we've said many times, the Torah over here, you have to study it in terms of the plain pshat, as we've said. The plain pshat is not talking about either a wise son or a wicked son. Although, you do have, in chapter 13, Pasuk Yedalad, that's 14, V'hoyek yishalcha bincha macha lemar. And it will be when your son asks you on the morrow, saying, Mazos, what is this? V'yamarte lov, you shall say unto him, B'chozek yod hotziyanon Hashem v'mitzrayim v'beis avadim. Then you go on and describe the this question, what is this, mazos, does seem to be a simpler question. So just on the level of the plain pshat, you can detect something. It's not formulated. Thus, I guess it's an easier call over here to say that this is the simple son. Okay, fine. With regard to the chacham, in terms of the drash, that means to say that we have to study the Torah in different ways. We have to study the Torah in terms of the plain meaning, but we see this many, many times. But then there are tremendous nuances and implications. And those people who understand how to make the proper deductions can arrive at those conclusions. Now, if you study the Chacham, it's not that difficult to see why he's being called the Chacham. He's being called the Chacham because of how he relates to the phenomena. That is, he's got all the elements of being a wise son. Humbleness. He recognizes, he has the appropriate reaction to the phenomena. That is, he's reviewed it and he's noticed certain things about it. That there's different categories. How he observes things. He categorizes. He notices that there are testimonies which have to do with memorializing certain events of the past. That's one category. Just the idea of categorization is very significant. That when a person studies a subject, he doesn't just have an undifferentiated mass. He tries to categorize, to notice. So he's observant, and he notices, and he categorizes. And he's broken them down into three categories. As opposed to the simple son, what's this? That means it's a certain laziness, a certain lack of curiosity, mental laziness. He's not really thinking about the phenomena. It's very simplistic. Secondly, he mentions the fact, he recognizes that God, that they come from God. So that's very, very significant. That lies at the heart of a person's approach. If a person recognizes the source, so this engenders within him a certain attitude of humbleness and also a recognition that there's tremendous wisdom over here. So he wants to partake of that wisdom. Now notice also that God commanded you. Now some people have said, well, how is that different than the Rashi who says, Lachem, you, that God commanded you? There's a big difference. Because he means over here, this is humbleness, that God established a system. And as we've said, the Torah, there's the written Torah, and then there's the oral Torah. And the reason he's asking the question is because he recognizes that there's a whole methodology, that he needs to be instructed. He's coming to be instructed. And that's why he says that God commanded it. It's the Lord our God. Insofar as that's concerned, it's our God. So he's part of the group. However, he recognizes that God has designated the teachers, that God transmitted it to the teachers, and in order for him to have access to it, he has to be instructed by the teachers. That's why he's, that's what he means when he says that God commanded you. Not me, but there's a system. In order to get the wisdom of the system, you have to operate within the categories of the system. It's transmitted from one generation to the next. The Rashi is a bit subtle over here. It's very subtle. The Rashi, interestingly enough, doesn't mention God. That can't be by accident. When the Torah formulated, the Chacham, the wise son, makes that statement. That's the essential statement. The essential statement is, the reason why I'm interested, the reason why I'm coming here, or I want to study, is because I recognize that this comes from a higher source. If not that, that's the starting point. So that's the appropriate reaction to an individual who recognizes that he's dealing with something which comes from God. The Rashi doesn't even mention that. He just looks at it from the standpoint of Avoda. And Avoda does carry the connotation. This is brought down in the Yerushalmi. I saw it in the Rabbi Hirsch Haggadah. It does carry the association and the subtlety that it's a work. The word Avoda also means work. So the term Avoda, it's used to describe the enslavement, labor of the Jews in Egypt. That word, of course, is also service in the Mikdash. But the implication is that it's work, that it's labor, that it's a burden. The idea, it's like a burden. It's like, why do we have to do these religious burdens? And the key word over here is lachem, to you. What is this service unto you? He has not included himself. So he's denied the divinity, that this is a system of truth, and basically he's separated himself. Now what does that mean? Ulefisha hoti es atzmo min haklal. Kafar ba'ikar. Because he's separated himself from the klal, from the group. He's a kofar. He's one who denies a foundation. In what sense has he separated himself from the group? It's not saying that he's left the people, that he's no longer part of Klal Yisrael, that he's joined the different people. That's not what we're saying over here. So what does it mean? The idea that he's removed himself from the Klal is, even if he regards himself as being a part of the Jewish people, but he's broken the real bond, which is the mitzvos. The true klal that we're talking about, the true group, is the group which is defined by their allegiance to the mitzvos. For example, in many places, where the Torah lo sisna sachicha bilvavecha, you should not hate your brother in your heart. Whenever it uses these terms of brotherhood or friend, it means achicha b'mitzvos, that one is defined as a brother in terms of the mitzvos, that we both observe the system. Once a person breaks away from that system, so all you have is the biological phenomenon. That's not the real idea. By not identifying with the mitzvos, by making it into you, but not him. So therefore he's saying that it's the subjective system, and it's not for him. But it doesn't seem... You don't get the sense of someone who doesn't want to be part of the Jewish people. That you don't get the sense. Because then what's the point? He wouldn't be asking the question. But the idea is that he's a kofar. Because he separates himself. He denies that this is objectively true. That he denies that this comes from God. He's saying it's just a religion. So what is it to you? What significance does it have to you? To me it doesn't have significance. But he's curious. He's asking. It is true that he's asking. But the way he formulates the question is already making a statement. He's not really asking, he's making a statement. He's already come to a certain conclusion. What makes him into a Russia? Why are we being harsh? It's pretty harsh. Because he maintains, this is what's very difficult for people to accept today. That because you maintain a position, even if that position is false, why you wouldn't call somebody evil or wicked. It's very important to understand why he's evil or wicked. It's one thing to say that he's wrong, he's got the wrong idea. Very few people today would characterize him this way. They're saying, look, he regards this as being another religion. There's many religions out there. He's not being disrespectful. He's not being disrespectful. He's saying, what is the significance to you? It's like you encounter a different group of people with a strange or different, let's say, kind of religion, and you're curious. Like you would be in Pennsylvania, you'd visit the Amish, and you would ask them, well, what's the reason for these customs? What significance do they have to you? Then it would be correct to say that. It's interesting, if you were to ask the Amish, what significance do these customs have to you, they would not be upset by that implication. They would say, yes, for us. They'd be very happy. This is for us. We do it because it makes sense to us to do it. They wouldn't be offended that they're not claiming this is a universal thing. It seems to me that there is a defect over here, that the question reflects a certain defect. Because the appropriate reaction, there is an appropriate reaction to the phenomena. That if a person were in the appropriate state, they would look at the phenomena in an objective way, they would recognize uniqueness. There is no other system like this. They would see the classification. They would see the intelligence, the intellectuality, the wisdom. Then they'd want to learn, study, and understand. What motivates the Russia is a refusal. It is a certain stubbornness of the heart. It's a refusal. Because he wants to live in his own world. He wants to determine his own reality. It's not a legitimate kind of a mistake. He should study the phenomena. If he studied the phenomena honestly, intelligently, and he said, at the end, I just can't see it, I don't get it, I'm having an intellectual problem, that would be one thing. Then he would not be a Russia. But there's no true desire to understand. He's reached a certain conclusion in which he's negating it as being a purely subjective thing because of the power of his instincts. He does not want to subordinate his instincts to a higher authority, to the will of God. That's why he's called a Russia. That's the essence of a Russia. That he refuses to live according to an objective reality, authority, that there's anything more supreme he wants than his own instinctual desires and his own outlook, his own views, his own sense of reality that dictates everything. He does not want to subordinate himself to Hashem. That's what makes him into a Russia. It's not an intellectual phenomenon. The appropriate reaction of a humble individual who is seeking for a truth would be different. But someone who's decided that he wants to live according to his emotions and his instincts rejects that. So truth is an enemy to him. And therefore he takes a position that there is no truth. And thus, on the surface, he may seem to be very democratic. You have to have his opinions. Everybody's got an opinion. That person that acts like that tries to come off as being the good person. And that the bad person is the one who's maintaining that there is a truth. Once you say there's a truth, then you're saying that everything else is false, that there's true and false. In the world of today, which is a very hedonistic, instinctually oriented world, that person who's the absolutist, so to speak, that there is an absolute. Judaism maintains the absolute. That there is an absolute. That's because Hashem is the ultimate reality and the truth. Hashem is the ultimate truth, and Hashem reveals and Hashem determines and dictates. And man is a created being whose well-being depends upon understanding and acting in accordance with the truth that's revealed by Hashem. That's a righteous person. And that's a chacham. It's all the same. The Amar Naval Balibo, the base individual, says in his heart there is no God. Basically, he's saying there's no God. But the motivation to say there's no God stems from a certain corruption of the heart. That it goes contrary to his emotional desire. He can't subordinate his emotions. So he can't tolerate the idea of God. That's why he's wicked. It's not clear whether we answer him or not. There is a certain ambivalence because it seems that we do. What? Well, first of all, if we don't answer him, so what's the point of studying about him? Ostensibly, the idea is to prepare ourselves for different approaches. Also, bear in mind, it doesn't have to be one of the sons. You will always have people like this at the Seder. There's always different kinds of personalities. These are prototypes of different types of personalities. And today, the Russia is a very popular one. On the surface, he's very polite and interested and curious, but the underlying foundation is that only as a curiosity. You cannot maintain that yours is the truth. True and false are not very popular today, especially in the realm of what we would call philosophy of life. For us, that's what religion is, true philosophy of life, in the realm of morals and ethics. The Agada instructs us that we should blunt his teeth and say unto him, because of this did God do for me when I left Egypt. Me and not him. So it starts off, it gives the impression that you do have an answer for him, but then it drifts off into the third person. That is, if we're following along this line, if I'm talking directly to him, because of this did God do for me, when I left Egypt, me and not you it should have been. What do you mean me and not him? Who's the him? If I'm talking directly to someone, I'm not going to, and I mean him, I don't say me and not him. Who's the him? I don't use the third person. Elu Hoyashav, had he been there, he would not have been redeemed. You're switching over from the second person to the third person, which has led some commentators to the idea that we don't even answer him. We're not supposed to answer him. But we're concerned that he might have had some effect on others at the table, and we're talking to them. In the past, we had an explanation for this. We learned that it's directing you to answer him. Which, to me, that makes sense. Although there are other factors that indicate that it's not the Rambam, by the way, does not mention. He goes to the different sons. He only mentions three types. That is the Chacham, the wise son, and then different degrees of an undeveloped son. The son that asks a simple question, then the one that doesn't even ask. He talks about three sons. He does not mention the Rasha, which would indicate that yet in the Rambam's Haggadah you will have the idea of the four sons. However, it's possible to learn that we do give him an answer. In which case, I explained one time the switch from the second person to the third person. And that is if you read it this way, that you blunt his teeth and say to him, because of this, did God do for me when I left Egypt? That's the statement that you make. The next part, me and not him, is not what you tell him. That's telling you. That's the idea. That's what you're supposed to, that's what it's conveying, but you're not saying it directly. Which means to say that you have to use subtlety. You have to use a certain amount of psychology over here. That, because if you're just going to say that to him, it's going to be insulting. I don't see what benefit that would be. I don't think the point is to, the blunting of the teeth there is not to hit him and to hurt him or to embarrass him. That's not going to achieve anything. So if that's the case, then you wouldn't give him an answer at all. Those who maintain that there's no point in answering him. Let's face this challenge. Well, how could you answer him? What answer could there be? You can't give an answer to someone who denies the truth. The wise son, you can give an answer. He acknowledges there's a truth. This contains truth. This contains wisdom. So instruct me in the wisdom. That's beautiful. The simple son is not denying truth, but he's on a simple level. Fine. And even the son that doesn't know to ask, he's the one. The son that doesn't know to ask is not necessarily because he's too young and not developed mentally. The son, in my opinion, there are two types of sons who don't know to ask. Two types. One is religious, one is too religious. One is simply too religious to ask, and the other one is not religious enough to care. The one that doesn't know to ask is he doesn't care. He's just not interested. He wants to know when we're going to get to the food. He wants to go downstairs and play with some of the games, whatever it is. He's just not interested. So he doesn't ask. To ask, you have to have a certain level of interest. So to speak, he's been turned off. But it's interesting, in my opinion, we have a new phenomenon of someone who doesn't know to ask. He's so religious, he's so faith-based, he's so affected by all the other religions where you don't ask any questions, where it's a bigger mitzvah to just do and not to ask, so he doesn't know that in this religion you're really supposed to ask. So he may go through the motions of, but he's not really asking. He will ask questions only because that's part of the ritual. He acts according to the ritual, with no desire for a deeper understanding, because he doesn't realize that the whole essence of Judaism lies in the deeper understanding. That's another version of doesn't know to ask. But that's I don't know if that's what the Haggadah intended, but that's come into being in our time. The question really arises, is it possible to have an answer for someone who's just denying? How can you answer someone if they don't have the same premise? Your premise is that there is such a thing as truth. If they don't have that idea and everything is subjective, and you have your truth, I have my truth, so how can you give them an answer? What are you going to say? So you're suggesting that we explain the beauty of it. So fine, he'll acknowledge that there's beauty, but he'll say there's beauty elsewhere too. Once it's rooted in a certain baseness, once it's rooted in a very powerful emotional desire that each person should be free to live according to their whims, then he's not going to be persuaded. He may have a certain respect and say, you know, it's more rational than the other things I've heard. But so what? If he's not searching for the truth, if indeed, to the contrary, his objective is to tear down the notion of truth, then what are we going to answer him? Is there any approach that's possible? That's the question that has to be raised. I'm going to suggest a possibility. I think that in a situation like that, where a person is not has reached a conclusion, and that conclusion is rooted in a certain faulty attitude. It's the underlying attitude that's going to prevent them. Even if he likes your answer, so what? So it's nice, very nice. To the contrary, if the answer is pleasing to him, because he bases himself on whether something is pleasing to him or not. So you'll give an answer, and if that, whether he'll like it or not, will not be dependent upon its objective criteria of logic, but whether he finds it pleasing. So very often he'll like an idea. A lot of people go to shul and they may like an idea. But you'll notice that most people I've found, whether they agree or don't agree, it's generally speaking, it's based on how they feel about it. If they feel comfortable with it, then okay. It's not, very few people are operating by the sheer logic of the situation, the intellectual criteria, very few. There are some, but it's very few, and it takes a lot of training. Mostly it has to do with whether they like it. Now I think that the only breakdown that could be possible, the only blunting of the teeth that could be possible, are two factors. One, an idea, because you're asking me, what does it mean to me? And I'm not going to tell you what it means to me the way you would want. What's the significance of this? What's the significance? I'm not going to do. I'm going to go back to the source. I'm doing it because God commanded it, because of this. Because of this, God took me out of Egypt. And that is to say, the foundation. He's attacking that idea. He's saying it's objective. Your idea, you're not going to answer by showing him that from the mitzvah itself, what the idea of the mitzvah itself is, but the source. This is what it is to me, that the significance of this is that this is comes from the Creator, and He intervened and redeemed us from Egypt for the sake of doing these commands and living this way of life. That's what it means to me. That's why it says Lee. I think there's another factor. And Rabbi Hirsch alludes to this idea too. That in these situations, the only thing you have left sometimes is the absolute. You can't argue with him about his philosophy, your philosophy. The foundation is from God. If it's from God, that's the position. Then it makes sense. Then it's not lachem. Then it's for everybody. Now, if he wants to come out openly and negate God, fine, let him come out openly and do so. But you're doing it because this has its origins in God. It comes from God. That's what you have to tell him. And Lee, the idea, in my opinion, of Lee is sometimes, see, that's something that a person has to grapple with. Even if people rebel and seemingly deny and so forth, but people are grappling with the idea of God. There's a certain element within man that recognizes that there has to be something out there. So over here you're telling him that basically you're in denial of God. That the Creator, the universe has a Creator, and this comes from the Creator. At this point in time he's not going to maybe accept it, but that must be your stance. That's the reason why I'm keeping the Torah. I'm not keeping it because I like this makes sense to me and that makes sense to me. That's after the fact. I'm keeping it because God took us out of Egypt, because God revealed himself, because I have revelation. That was my main point in that dialogue about pluralism. It all gets down to revelation. I didn't go into, if you'll notice, I did not get into comparing the two religions, which is a lot of people want to take that approach, that we say this and they say that. I didn't feel that was the bottom line. Because then people will argue, maybe yours is a little bit better, maybe that. You know, once you get into that area, I said the whole issue of religion is revelation. That's it. It stands or falls on revelation. You have to come to a conclusion, a decision, whether it makes sense to say that it's revelation. And that's where that was my approach. And Judaism is founded on revelation in a manner which makes sense to us, that this was a revelation. It's based upon opening our minds,
studying the phenomena. It was mass revelation. Once you have that, then we have to ask ourselves the question, what's their claim to revelation? That was the basis. Once I established that, I did go on to show that it's man-made and the ideas are absurd. But that was my secondary line of defense. The primary line of defense is, that's why I keep the Torah. Because God redeemed me and God gave it to me. Also, there's the li factor, me. Which means you're also using one other thing over here. That if you want to have a relationship with me, now, people have to know to be firm. A lot of you talk, this is talking about a child who strayed. Not, as Rabbi Hirsch says, not every generation of the children going to be loyal to the Torah. You'll have generations where they rebel against the Torah. At the end of the day, the parent has to be firm. In my opinion, the parent must be firm. And this is my essence. This is me, Lee. And whoever wants to be connected with me, because there is the idea that the child identifies with the parent. So the child wants to retain that sense of closeness and love. And the point being, you're not saying it directly. You're not saying, it's leave a low, low. That God did this for me, and God established a certain community, but not for him. That is, this defines whether you're part of that community or not. This is my essence. You have to tell a person, the only thing that will convince a person is the conviction, the strength of your conviction. That's very, very important, because for a person like this, that's more important than logic. He doesn't go by logic, but he is impressed by a certain conviction. That does have an effect upon him. The fact that you, who he looks up to, regard this as being so important that it's your essence, you have to take a stand for Torah. And the message he gets is that if he remains in this state, he will never have that kind of closeness that he would like. You're not saying you're going to throw him out. That's not necessarily a good idea either. Yet, obviously, we're talking about different cases too, subjective, how to handle it. So no one is saying to throw him out, but the message is that this is an absolute. There are certain things you do not yield on, and that, therefore, that will have an influence upon him. People are affected by that. The strength of your conviction, people are affected by that. Obviously, it depends who. Since you're an intelligent individual, the Torah is wisdom, and you live by reason, that conviction is something which carries weight. It's not for naught that everybody persecuted, everybody wanted the Jews to acknowledge their religion. Everybody's bothered by the fact that the Jews won't acknowledge their system. Because the Jews are regarded as a people that live according to wisdom, a superior people in that respect. And there is that implication that if you really can't get too close if you remove yourself from that idea. That's the basis of the whole identification.